Yeah, so we start? Yeah. So before we start again, try to generate correct motivation, yeah? Especially we're going to talk about emptiness for the purpose of eliminating ignorance, yeah? To eliminate destructive emotions and to eliminate samsara and motivate bodhicitta to achieve the state of enlightenment, right? So try to generate either of those motivations for yourself. And then in front is Sakyamuni Buddha, and surrounding yourself all the sentient beings of the six realms and human aspect, and undergoing individual sufferings, and by looking at their sufferings, generate a wish for them to be free of suffering. And for that purpose, we're going to lead them in the prayers, yeah, for the purpose of attending the session today. So prayers, page number 5. Guru, teacher, Bhagavan, Tathagata, Arats, perfect, complete Buddha, perfect in knowledge and good conduct, Sagata, know the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed. Teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the Bhagavan, the glorious conqueror, Sakyamuni, I prostrate my offerings, go for refuge. Guru, teacher, Bhagavan, Tathagata, Arats, perfect, complete Buddha, perfect in knowledge and good conduct, Sagata, know the world, supreme guide of beings to be subdued. Teacher of gods and humans, to you, the Bhagavan, the glorious conqueror, Sakyamuni, I prostrate make offerings, go for refuge. Guru, teacher, Bhagavan, Tathagata, Arats, perfect, complete Buddha, perfect in knowledge and good conduct, Sagata, know the world, supreme guide of human beings to be subdued. Teacher of gods and humans, to you, the Buddha, Bhagavan, the glorious conqueror, Sakyamuni, I prostrate make offerings, go for refuge. When supreme amongst humans, you were born out of the earth, you played out the 7 strides and then said, I am supreme in this world. To you, O wise, then I prostrate, with pure bodies, form supremely pure, wisdom ocean like a golden mountain. Fame that blazes in the 3 worlds, winner of the best, savior, to you I prostrate. With supreme science, face like a spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Thus free like you, the 3 worlds are not, incomparable wise one, to you I prostrate. The savior having great compassion, the teacher having all understanding, the field of merit should call this like a vast ocean, to you the one count of dustness I prostrate. The purity that frees from attachments, the virtue that frees from the lower realms, the one part sublime, pure reality, the Dharma that pacifies our prostrate. Those who are liberated and show the path of liberation, the holy field qualified realizations, who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you, sublime community, tending virtue, our prostrate. Do not commit any unwholesome actions. Engage in perfect wholesome actions. Subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. A star, a defective view, a butter lamp, flame, an illusion, a dewdrop, a water bubble, a dream, lightning, clouds, sea, all things like this. To these merits, may all sentient beings attain the rank of all seeings, subdue the four faults, and be delivered from samsara, ocean, the bird that waves of ages, sickness, and death. Heart Sutra, next page. I prostrate to the 3 noble, rare, sublime ones. Thus did I hear at one time, the Bhagavan was dwelling in the Virgis Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At a time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perfection. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokitesvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those 5 aggregates also as empty of nature. Then, to the power of the Buddha, the Venpa Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokitesvara: how should any son of the lineage train to wishes to practice the activities of profound perfection of wisdom? He said that in the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokitesvara said this to the Venerable Shariputra: Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice activities of profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this, correctly and repeating, beholding those 5 aggregates also as empty of nature. Form is empty, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form, and form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness without characteristics, unproduced, unseized, stainless, not without stain, not distinct and not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no consistent factors, no consciousness. No eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visible form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no eye element, up to and including no mind element, and no mental conscious element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, and up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similar, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and part. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. The mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly complete awakening, the Onsubra, perfect complete enlightenment, in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the Onsubra's mantra, the mantra unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacified all suffering, should be known as truth, since not false. The mantra of perfection of wisdom is declared, Tayata, Gatagata, Paragata, Parasangata, Bodhisattva. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train from perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, Arya Abhidhamsvara Singh. Well said, son of the lineage, it is like that, it is like that. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you indicated, and even Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the Venerable Shariputra and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Abhidhamsvara, and those surrounding there entirely, along with the worlds of gods, humans, asuras, and Kandavas, were overjoyed and highly praised, spoken by the Bhagavan. From the holy supreme realm of Kachera, you who possess the power of clairvoyance and actual emanations, look, a practitioner of distraction without which to the host of the kings and the tree boats are prostrate. Akasamarasasana, samarayabhi, akasamarasasana. Akasamara samnasam samarayape tayata gata gata paragata parasangata bodhisoha. By the teachings of the noble three sublime ones possessing the power of truth, may all hindrance be averted, may it be eliminated, may it be pacified. May all enemies and negative forces opposed to the Dharma, and may the host of 80,000 obstacles be pacified. May it be free from harmful conditions to the Dharma, and may it excellence in accordance to the Dharma, and may it be auspicious and perfect happiness here and right now. The foundation of all good qualities is the kind and perfect Guru. Correctly devoting to him is the root of the path. By clearly seeing this and applying great effort, please bless me to rely upon with great respect. Understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once, is difficult to find again, it's greatly meaningful. Please bless me to generate the mind that unceasingly day and night and takes essence. This life is impermanent as a water bubble. Remember how quickly it decays and death comes. After death, just like the shadow, a shadow follows the body. The result of white, black and white karma flow. Finding firm and definite conviction in this, please bless me always to be careful, to abandon even the slightest negativities and accomplish all virtuous deeds. Seeking samsaric pleasures is door to all suffering. They are uncertain, cannot be relied upon. Recognizing these shortcomings, please bless me to generate a strong wish for the bliss of liberation. Led by this pure thought, mindfulness, alertness and great caution arise. The root of the teachings is keeping the prajnamoksha vows. Please bless me to accomplish this essential practice. Just as I have fallen into the sea of samsara, so have all modern migratory beings. Please bless me to see this and train the supreme bodhicitta and bear responsibility of freely transmitting migratory beings. Even if I develop only bodhicitta, but I will not practice three types of morality, I will not achieve enlightenment. With my clear recognition of this, please bless me to practice the bodhisattva vows with great energy. Once I have pacified distraction to wrong objects and correctly analyzed the meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified part of common abiding, especially insight. Having become a pure vessel by training in the general parts, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. At a time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I've become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. Then, having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, Please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. Like that, may the gurus who show the noble paths and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. Please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. In all my lives, never be separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. By completing the qualities and stages of paths, may I quickly attain the state of Vajradhara. Then we do a short mandala. Yeah, so today we're going to talk about the most important teachings of the Buddha, the most difficult one, but the most essential important one, because all the teachings of the Buddha were actually preparations for the teachings on emptiness. So also, those who are familiar with Lama Tsongkhapa's works of the Lam Rim, yeah, then you know in the three principal aspects of the path, it also says, without the wisdom realizing ultimate reality, yeah, even though you have generated renunciation or the mind of enlightenment, yeah, one cannot cut the root of samsara. Therefore, make effort in the methods to realize dependent origination. Yeah, so, yeah, that's true. Yeah, so according to the motivation we just generated in the beginning, then we also saw that, emptiness, of course, is needed in order to progress on the paths for liberation and enlightenment. Yeah. And also, you know, to eliminate ignorance. If ignorance is less strong, first of all, maybe you don't have the realization of emptiness, but if ignorance is its potential becomes a bit less, right, by reflecting upon emptiness, then afflictions will lose their potentials as well. Though they will still come up, but they won't be that strong as before. And so even in this life, there's great benefit. And if the afflictions become less, then of course, you have a more subdued mind. And with that more subdued mind, you can practice morality much better. And by practicing morality, you will be able to find the precious human rebirth. Yeah? So with the precious human rebirth, we can accomplish, again, progress in the sense of achieving future precious human rebirths, liberation and enlightenment. And so emptiness is quite important, as you can see. And yesterday we talked about it also quite a bit. Yeah. Also, when we read the Heart Sutra, it says no this, no that. You know, it's not that there's no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. They exist, right? But they exist. But no, no, no means, or in Russian, during when His Holiness asked the different languages to recite the Heart Sutra in Bulgaria during the public teachings, then in Russian there's a lot of, I don't know Russian, but you hear the nyet, 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 so you know there's no this, no that, no that. So every language has its own kind of uncommon no this, no that. You know? Can you put the people again or not? I see only myself. It's a kind of a...
Sorry?
look in the mirror. If you people can I read for you? I don't know.
Whether you want
to
do?
To have the people here.
Yeah?
That's better. Just show me how to do it again next time.
Okay.
Yeah, that's better. I feel more connected to the rest of the world. So now I see a few familiar faces all of a sudden. Yeah, good. So, yeah. So that means that emptiness is pretty important. And, well, as we just read in the Heart Sutra, no this, no that, yeah, that refers to nothing exists from its own side. Then, in a similar way, it says sthita, gata gata, paragata, parasamgata, bodhisoha. That mantra within the Heart Sutra also basically describes the whole path, you know, to liberation, enlightenment. You know, it's all included, the five paths, so to say. You know. Tayata means it's as such, you know. Gata is the first part. Yeah. So then already on the first part, if you follow the bodhisattva path, for example, the majorities of the bodhisattvas who enter the path of accumulation have realized emptiness before. Yeah. All the intelligent bodhisattvas realize emptiness before bodhicitta. Among the lesser intelligent ones, yeah, it's been, if you're interested, Kyalsab Jay quotes that in his commentary on the Abhisamanakara, that the majority of the lesser intelligent, of course, the lesser intelligent are quite more intelligent than I am, or a few of you maybe, I don't know, but, you know, so that means that the lesser intelligent, most of them realize emptiness before bodhicitta. You know? Very interesting. So that's how they enter the first part, you know? The first gate. You know? And then they improve their realization of emptiness. It becomes more and more subtle, the duality between mind and the object emptiness starts to disappear on the second gate, yeah, on the part of preparation, so to say. And then on the part of seeing, gate, paragate, you know, paragate aspect, then it's a direct perception. Yeah, we talked about yesterday, when are the seeds of negative karma being eliminated? It happened on this part of seeing, you know, the gate, paragate, yeah, paragate. So those who study a bit more, it's very important to study grounds and paths. Unfortunately, it's not really a part of the discovering Buddhism, neither of the basic program, only the Vajrayana paths are part of it. But yeah, grounds and paths is very important. Why? Because if you understand the grounds and paths for Buddhist practitioner, then you understand the map. You know, you understand what is liberation, what is enlightenment. You know? So then for taking refuge makes a big issue, for the need to understand emptiness and how that realization of emptiness becomes more and more profound, you know. So that's all been described in these, what's called ground and paths. You know? So it says gate, gate, yeah? Paragate. So at the paragate, there's direct perception of emptiness. And then you can see, if you have realized emptiness, that by itself is not enough. Yeah. So on the first paragate, when you eliminate the seeds, there's two aspects, you know, with seeds. Those seeds that are kind of, they're in a way which is kind of what we call acquired, you know, which is acquired to tenets, habituations, so to say, that are not that strong, right? They've been eliminated on this part of seeing, yeah? A paragate. So the same too, what we talked about a few times before, habituations that are not that strong in the mind is easier to eliminate, right? If you smoke for 2 weeks like I did in this holiday, then it's easy to stop. But if you smoke for a few years, it's more difficult to stop, right? So on the part of seeing, then those seeds of the acquired apprehension, yeah, or grasping, apprehension is a better word actually, apprehension of inner and self, yeah, that has been eliminated. Yeah, then the seeds which is there since beginner's lifetime, that habituation is stronger, right? So they need more time. Yeah, same with an addiction, the stronger, the longer the addiction is. And that happens on the part of, next part is the part of meditation. Yeah, so that's a bit longer also in general. Yeah. Gate, gate, paragate, parasamgate. The parasamgate, that's the part of what we call meditation. So those who study a bit more, then you know what happens. You know, first you generate bodhicitta, right? The mind of enlightenment, a mind that wishes all sentient beings to be free of suffering. And not only be free of suffering, because that's compassion, that's one of the main causes for the mind of enlightenment, right? Then you generate a wish to attain a state, a development of mind with which you can accomplish that goal, right? Yeah, so that's based on the seven cause and effect method and the special intention, right? Yeah. So based on special intention, you take responsibility, and then you go a step further, and you see you have to develop yourself, and you wish to become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings in order to accomplish that task. Which task? The task of liberating sentient beings from their suffering. Yeah. So bodhicitta, or the mind of enlightenment, is a mind that wishes all sentient beings to be free of suffering, all sentient beings without exception, free of suffering, meaning not only the suffering of suffering, suffering of change, but the all-pervasive compounding form of suffering, right? All forms of suffering together with the causes. So that means you wish all sentient beings to be free of the coronavirus, you wish sentient beings to be free of any other sickness, and you also wish for sentient beings to be free of afflictions, because afflictions cause the suffering, right? So that's... and especially ignorance. So you wish all sentient beings to be free of ignorance, you see? So that's this mind of enlightenment, wishing all sentient beings to be free of suffering, including the cause of suffering. And for that purpose, you like to acquire or attain the state of enlightenment. Yeah. So then, as I said, compassion is one of the main causes for bodhicitta to happen or to come into being. Yeah. So in one of the practices, Vajrayana practices, Lama Sukhava. Then it's one of the second verse in that lineage guru prayer. It's very interesting. It says, having the basis of equanimity, you know, or generating the basis, or generate equanimity to have the basis, then with love and kindness is like the, you know, the fertilization of the moisture, you know, love and kindness. Yeah? The compassion is the cause, you know, for ultimate bodhicitta, or for, sorry, conventional bodhicitta in this case, conventional bodhicitta to rise, yeah, the mind of enlightenment. So it's very interesting to see we need this equanimity. Yes, we talked about the other day, without equanimity it's very difficult to say I want to become a Buddha for the benefit of all sentient beings, you know, except this one, except that one, and we don't like a particular individual. So that's why we have to have equanimity, right? So that's why Lama Tsongkhapa also in this very kind of complex Vajrayana practice, that's the second verse in this practice. Very interesting. You know, so that means that having the basis of equanimity and the moisture of love and kindness and the cause of great compassion, may bodhicitta be completely generated. You know, that's a very rough translation of that verse though, but yeah, that's what it says. Then, so you can see, yeah, compassion extremely important. If you study more emptiness, and especially now we're going to go over briefly over the 18th chapter, you know, of fundamental wisdom of Arjuna, it's a very profound chapter, you know. So this text by itself, yeah, was the basis for Chandrakirti, you know, to write the Madhyamika Avatara. You know, the Madhyamika Avatara, written by Chandrakirti, mainly deals with emptiness, and of course also the path to enlightenment. You know, the stages of the path to enlightenment in the presentation context of the Prasangika, right? So that text mainly deals with chapter 6, yeah, which is mainly referring to emptiness, right? Very elaborate, extremely elaborate. Without Chandrakirti, probably very difficult to realize emptiness. You know? Nagarjuna's works very clear, but still it's quite condense, and the differentiation between the different Buddhist tenets is not that clear. Same with Buddha Palita. So Chandrakirti made it so clear. You know? So then Chandrakirti made this incredible text, which is the basis for all the texts we study in the monastic system of the Nalanda tradition. Yeah? That's very moving, you know. Chandrakirti, when he starts with the text, he praises great compassion. Very interesting. He praises great compassion. You know? So then, why does he praise great compassion? Because he says, all Sravakas and Prachekas, you know, or all goodness of the world, so to say, you can say, right? They arise from the teachings of the Buddha. You know? Yeah, because thanks to these insights, this is a Buddhist kind of explanation, right? So every religion has these kind of uncommon features, right? Or every form of faith. So there it says all the goodness, right? And in particular, the goodness is, I'm adding, but it's a very technical aspect in the text, because it says all Sravakas and Prachekas, meaning those who achieve liberation, right? Those who achieve liberation. You know? And then before liberation, Prachekas, rebirth, etc., etc. You know? That all depends on these teachings of the Buddha. You know? And then these teachings of the Buddha depends on the Buddha, right? So it says the Sravakas and Prachekas, they arose from the Buddha. You know, that's what technically says in the text. You know? So arose from the Buddha, or born from the Buddha, you know. And then the Buddha arose from Bodhisattva. In order to become a Buddha, first you have to be Bodhisattva, right? Right? You know? So a Bodhisattva is a person who has this mind of enlightenment in his or her continuum, right? So the mind of enlightenment is described a mind that wants to become a Buddha in order to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. If you have that mind in your continuum, 24/7, not like we had last Sunday that Zoom stops, not like that. This bodhicitta mind is a realization that doesn't stop. There's no kind of, you know, breakdown or it stops. It's always present. Maybe sometimes it's more manifest, you know, than other times, but even during dreams, you know. So that's a realization of bodhicitta. So you can imagine, the more you habituate your mind by contemplating the suffering of sentient beings, equanimity, the whole sequence of the seven cause and effect method, you know, the more you do that, then the habituation comes and becomes easier and easier and easier. Yeah? For most of us, at the moment, anger is like that. It's like a spontaneous realization. You know? It's so easy to get angry, you know, without effort. We don't have to meditate, oh, let's get angry. How do I get angry again? You know? It's not like that, you know. But bodhicitta, we need effort, you know. So we have to contemplate first equanimity and then staging. So it takes quite some time to generate it, but possible. You know? If you see His Holiness having practiced over so many lifetimes, then you see when His Holiness talks, when He sees people, He says, oh, I feel so close, you know. That means it's a sign of realization that His Holiness has this equanimity, right? There's no distinction between the Chinese, you know, who caused him to have to leave the country, and his best friend who helps him to, his attendant to serve him the meals, you know. Though His Holiness doesn't make a distinction between those two. Why? Because His Holiness sees that all sentient beings are equal in the sense of wanting happiness, not wanting suffering, only they don't know how to accomplish it because they have afflictions, right? So the real enemy is not the person, but the afflictions. That's the real enemy, you know? So that's very striking. So if you have this kind of bodhicitta for all sentient beings without exception, if you have this wish, may all sentient beings, whoever, people you know, you don't know, you like, you dislike, may all of them, you know, be free from suffering. And may I cause that to happen, and for that purpose, I like to become a Buddha, right? So that's what we call bodhicitta. If that mind, as we just defined, is present in your continuum, you know, without any, you know, without any kind of, you know, drawbacks or being more strong or less strong, just spontaneous in your mind, that's a sign you have the realization, right? So in the beginning, it's true, you know, we learn a little bit about spirituality and then we lose the interest in worldly lives, you know, in worldly activities. That means that we start to understand something that becomes an inner part of our life, right? Same for me, when I went to these house parties in Rotterdam, we went to one place and they only had a permit until 4 o'clock in the morning. So then we went to another place, we had a permit until 9 or 10 in the morning, you know, so then we went to the other place. And then talking about habituations, then going back home in the train, you know, because we students, we had this free public transport. In the Netherlands those days, we were like kings. So we had free, and then every sound in the train sounded like the boom, 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 you know. It's very interesting, the habituation. But anyway, so then you become into this spiritual practice, and then you lose that interest, you see? Because you see there's more things in life that brings a little bit more satisfaction. So that means your understanding of those aspects, I don't say I have any realizations because I don't, but at least something starts to move, right? So that's true with bodhicitta, you know. In the beginning it's a bit difficult, but slowly you habituate yourself, you get convinced, you know, like stopping these worldly activities, or we see people who become more spiritual, their friends, they shift in another direction, you know, because the old friends, same for me, when I met my old friends from university, then some people thought I was cuckoo, or I lost it, you know, because I was walking around like this, you know. So yeah, some people think we are cuckoo, you know, when we sit here together and discussing these things, but yeah, that's no problem, you know, it doesn't matter, because it's not that easy to be understood, the things we're talking about, right, for the majority of the world. Why? Because the majority of the world, people, they just follow afflictions. There's no emotional intelligence, right? So that's, they believe in afflictions. The whole commercial industry is like scheduled to enhance these aspects of the mind. Yeah, so yeah. So then this bodhicitta, when it becomes spontaneous, it's what we call the realization, right? So at that time you enter the paths, the first gate, you know? So go back to this quotation of Chandrakirti, where he says, the sravakas and prachekas and all goodness arise from the teaching of the Buddha, the teaching arises from the Buddha arises from the bodhisattva, there where we are, right? Because a bodhisattva is a person who has the realization of bodhicitta in his or her continuum, right? And then Chandrakirti goes further, and then he says, the Buddhas arise from bodhisattvas, and the bodhisattvas, they arise from great compassion. Very interesting. Because, I'm missing. The bodhisattvas arise from bodhicitta, right? Because if you have bodhicitta in your mind, you'll be called bodhisattva. Yeah, bodhi means enlightenment, sattva means a heroic person, you know, with a very strong determination, like His Holiness, you know, like, oh, if the Chinese kill me now, it doesn't matter, next life I just continue, you know, that kind of determination, right? So that means, that's why Janju Senpa in Tibetan, Janju means enlightenment, Senpa means heroic beings, you know, like the heroes, the strong ones, you know. So the bodhisattvas, Chandrakirti says, they arose from bodhicitta, right? Because if you bodhicitta in your mind, you become a bodhisattva, if it's spontaneous. You know, he entered the first gate, you know, the gate, paragate, parasamgate, bodhisoha. Yeah, so the bodhisoha is enlightenment, right? So gate, first two parts, then parasamgate was the part of seeing, remember? You see emptiness directly, right? Parasamgate, kasa, gate, paragate, right? I said paragate or not? Yeah, paragate is the part of seeing, right? You see emptiness directly, and what it is, we try to cover today. And then parasamgate is this meditation again and again and again, you know, meditating on emptiness. And then eliminating all those seeds like a washing machine, you know. If you have different programs in a washing machine when the clothes are really, you know, when children, when they play outside in the dirt, the clothes are very dirty. You know, if you have to wash those clothes, it takes time. So that means you have to soak it first and then put it in a washing machine. So same for our mind, you know, there's more coarser forms of afflictions and more subtler ones. You know, so that needs a program, you know. The washing machine has a program, you know. You can choose, you know, sportswear, 45 minutes or heavy duty, or, you know, so you can choose. So for us, same thing, the mind, same thing, you know. We need a kind of program. Yeah, so this program is kind of those five parts, right? Gata, gata, para, gata, para, samgata. Yeah? And then when it says bodhisoha, then the job is done from the point of view of mental development, right? Yeah. So then Chandrakirti says, okay, those who are liberated, you know, the goodness arises from teaching of the Buddha, teaching of the Buddha arises from the Buddha. The Buddha arose from being a bodhisattva, and the bodhisattva arose from generating bodhicitta, right? And then, Chandrakirti says, and bodhicitta arose from great compassion. You see? Very moving. You know, because That's also same as the Code of Lama Tsongkhapa in a very profound Vajrayana text, you know, practice. The second verse talks about it. I just try to translate, not perfect translation, but yeah. So the basis equanimity, right? And then the moisturing aspects, love and kindness, and the cause, you know, seed cause for bodhicitta is this compassion, great compassion. Yeah. So that's how Chandrakirti started the text. Then he moves on in the text and says there's three types of compassion, three different types. And that's also why, because I'm still motivating you for emptiness, you see, I'm still trying. Because at least if you get motivated, you get inspired. And then hardships are difficult. Like this all night long house parties in Rotterdam, there was no hardship, you know, because you enjoy, and then it doesn't matter to go all the way to 9 o'clock in the morning, go back home, have breakfast, and, you know, put yourself to sleep again, you know, so there's no hardship. Though, you know, for a few weeks, you're still kind of a little bit, you know, not really as before. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so the hardship is no problem. So that's why if you enjoy things, that's why I said before, if you do retreats, be kind to yourself, you know? Don't push, don't squeeze, just make nice kind of schedule, have your meals, and not too much, of course, don't eat too much, or you fall asleep during the sessions, but just be kind, you know? Then it's very easy. And then the mind is happy, and then it's same with study, you know? You just enjoy, then it's so easy, and you absorb much better, you know? So that's a skillful means. When I'm involved in I don't like to give advice because I don't have any realizations, I don't have clairvoyance, so it's very difficult for me to give advice to people. But yeah, these things I like to share. So yeah, then where are we? Oh yeah, Chandrakirti. So then he says great compassion, right? So great compassion, three types, you know? So one type, the first type of compassion is a compassion that thinks the suffering of sentient beings by focusing upon the suffering of sentient beings, having a wish to free them, right? Roughly, it's very rough. I make it all quite simplified. So, you know, I do it very technical, then it becomes extremely academic. And then some people find it difficult. Yeah. So I keep it simple, you know. So that means that the first compassion is this compassion focusing upon the suffering of sentient beings in general and generate a wish for them to be free, you know? Yeah, first one. And then you see, that's a good point, that's amazing, you know, to have this wish. This is not many people in this world, they're able to think about it. So, very precious. So then you see the importance of understanding more of samsara and the mind, then this compassion can be more profound, you know. So that's what Chandrakirti says, those who have a realization of impermanence, you know, momentary and changing nature of reality, you know? Momentary changing nature of our body, our mind, the table, the Zoom, the computer, it all, what we talked about, it looked all that concrete, but actually it's momentary changing, right? Yeah, so if you understand momentary changing well, it prevents a lot of problems as we saw, right? So if you see that all sentient beings, not just suffering like the first one, but suffering every single second, you know. If you have an understanding of impermanence, you realize that to a certain extent, right? So not out, but by contemplating and then using other reasons, of course. So that means that if you really understand that all sentient beings not now suffering with the coronavirus, it's coronavirus is just the suffering of suffering, right? It's just one aspect of a very coarse form of suffering. But of course, people are suffering because of the coronavirus. It's more complex, right? It's due to karma, due to causes and effect relationship, external conditions, internal causes and conditions. It's a very complex system, you know. So to understand in that whole system that coronavirus is just one small aspect of the sufferings of humans on the planet in this particular time, right? So if you look at the whole picture, it's much more intense, you know. The suffering of sentient beings. So that means if you have understanding of impermanence, you know, that's, and the realization is there, like spontaneous, you know, then you can see that all sentient beings actually are suffering every single moment, second by second by second, you know. So then you can imagine that compassion becomes much stronger, you know. The wish for others, you cannot bear to see the suffering of others anymore. You want to act, you know. So that means that this great compassion, when there is when there is impermanence, then it's, you know, it's stronger, right? Yeah. So then Chandrakirti says there's a second one, the second compassion, you know. And then he says, if you have a realization of emptiness, then the compassion becomes even stronger, you know, even more profound. Why? Because if you understand emptiness, you understand ignorance. If you understand ignorance, you know why people, or sentient beings in general, are suffering. As we saw in the 12 links, right? Because of ignorance, there's afflictions. Because of afflictions, there's activity. And karma has been created, it comes to ripening. And next life, things go in a similar kind of habituation. There's no spiritual kind of progress, right? Yeah, you see? So that means that Chandrakirti, where he says that, you know, if you have a realization of emptiness, then this compassion becomes so much more intense, right? Because you understand why sentient beings are suffering, because of this ignorance. And also you understand it's a possibility for them to get liberated from that compassion, also from that ignorance, you know? Because you see it's possible to eliminate it. You see that? What His Holiness says, if you think about emptiness a lot, you think, oh, liberation is possible, right? Because you take away this link of ignorance. You know? Yeah? So that's that great compassion based on understanding emptiness is very profound, right? So that's why on the first day, I think we did a quotation of the great seventh Dalai Lama, also in a particular practice where it says, Jantra Chogya Ranshin Chen, Sentri Kula Nevali. So, Dema Toba. So means that all sentient beings have this potential to achieve enlightenment. Why? Because their mind is lacking inherent existence. Because their mind, the ignorance in their minds, first of all, is not innate part of their mind. It's like the white clouds who were absent today in London. There's only blue sky. I know in your place, all the blue sky, I can't see, but yeah, some sun in Somerset, sunny weather, I see. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I can see in the Netherlands, I can see, but yeah. Yeah, India probably, India for sure. Yeah, so blue sky, right? Yeah, Israel also maybe, yeah, maybe sun in the back, yeah. So it means that here also there's no blue sky, so that's why the sun, you see, is coming. So that means that the ignorance is also not in a part of the mind, right? Is that just temporary, you know? Yeah. So that if you have insight into emptiness, you see that. So you see the potentials for sentient beings to be free of suffering. And you see the potentials to achieve enlightenment. So based on those reasons, probably you realize emptiness before realizing bodhicitta, right? That's one reason, actually. But another reason is you don't believe what I'm saying now, but actually it's true. To realize emptiness is easier than bodhicitta. Mm-hmm. Many meditators who have Genima, you know, from Ganden, who accomplished the part of preparation. I had the fortune once when we were on pilgrimage to Lamdapur Rinpoche. I was not a monk yet, 1990, Kasa. I think 94 or something. Then we had opportunity also to meet with Genima and Ganden. So Genima, he did retreat in the forest with the tigers, all by himself. Mm-hmm. So he believed, people say he has accomplished about preparation. You know? So Genima, many other meditators, and certain texts, scriptures also is very similar, is that, especially what we just talked about, to realize emptiness is easier than bodhicitta. It looks difficult, you know? But why is emptiness easier? Because it's just a matter of fact of knowing what's ignorance and using reasons that cannot exist the way it appears. There you go. You know, that's it. But to get to what is ignorance is not an easy task. Yeah? And then, you know, to have a mind, you have to have concentration, of course, right? Without concentration, it's a bit difficult. You know? So, yeah. So then, yeah, and then it's just a matter of reasoning and get it. You know? I mean, get it probably still takes, you know, depends on your accumulation of merit, purification, having studied, and, you know, then you can get it, you know, after some time or a few lifetimes, whatever. You know? But you have to study, you know, only merit and purification by itself is not enough. You know? So another story is very, those stories, I don't know, maybe it's boring for you, I'm not sure. The stories are very inspiring, you know. There's because Lobsang Tenzin, I think. One of the meditators in Dharamshala in the 80s, His Holiness sent him to the US to do research with the scientists because he had this kind of inner fire and, you know, he had those kind of realizations, right? So he is a very inspiring story, extremely inspiring, because when he was young, he never studied. Very interesting. He didn't even know, he was Tibetan, but didn't know how to read or write Tibetan. He was in the army fighting the Chinese. He killed one of the Chinese officials. Then he fled to India, and Tibetans in India, he had a terrible, terrible life. You know, family members dying and fighting the Chinese, and then he came to India, and then the Tibetans thought he was a Chinese spy. So again, he was into trouble. Then he decided to enter the army in India, you know, Tibetan army. And then he started to get interested in these kind of things. And then he attended a few teachings, initially a lot in the Nyingma tradition. So his mind started to change, you know. Then he took ordination from His Holiness, and he went up and lived in the, in very simple places in Dharamshala, in the mountains above Dharamsala. One of his caves was so small you couldn't stretch your body. So he was kind of, So His Holiness didn't question him about realization of bodhicitta and renunciation, you know, because he had contemplated it so well, you know. And he had some good experience of the Vajrayana, two stages. But emptiness, because he never studied much, he only had one piece of paper, his notes, there was everything on emptiness. So His Holiness questioned him about emptiness. His Holiness was not completely satisfied. So His Holiness said, okay, you read Lamrim Chemo, you know, Lama Tsongkhapa's great exposition of stages of the path to enlightenment, and especially the special insight section. So we went again to the mountains, I think for 2 years at that time. Yeah, and then he got it right. You know, and then after that, His Holiness sent him to the West, to the scientists. And then arriving in the US, having a jet lag, they put him in a very cold lab. And they said, okay, here, you meditate. Not like that, but similar to that. And then, of course, it's very difficult, you know. But he stayed for 4 hours in Singapore in concentration at that time, and producing the inner fire and everything. So the scientists were pretty amazed. You know, they saw things they never saw before. It's true, you know, very interesting. If you read those research, that research, not only of this case, but many meditators. These meditators with sometimes they call the Olympic meditators. Daniel Coleman, he is his term. Daniel Coleman and Richard Davidson, they came to this kind of term, I think. Olympic meditators, meaning meditators who have like 15,000 to 50,000 hours of meditations behind, you know, behind their back. So then they produce gamma waves, you know, beyond the chart, meaning what's never measured before. So a high score in the gamma waves means that people don't grasp at things anymore, you know, like in the Dzogchen tradition, or people who have understanding of emptiness, you know, like His Holiness, when I said, Paul Ekman, you know, when he saw His Holiness, you know, facial expressions, you know, being like that. So, yeah, so that's interesting. The story is very inspiring, because sometimes you read the books and you study and try to meditate and then it doesn't really go, but then you see in the present time there's still people accomplishing these kind of realizations, right? So it's very inspiring. I find it very inspiring. Yeah. So then Chandragupta says this compassion which motivated or with the realization of emptiness is more profound, you see? So again, sales talk that emptiness is very important. You know, that is the main teaching of the Buddha, and all the teachings of the Buddha were like preliminaries, you know, to the view of emptiness. And so emptiness is not easy to be understood, but once understood, then great benefits. You know, just merely thinking about it by itself is a sign of having accumulated merit. So today we have a little bit less people than yesterday. Maybe it's mourning, or maybe it's emptiness, or maybe both. Or maybe something else. So, yeah, so very fortunate to be here, you know. Yeah. I also don't know much about emptiness, but luckily I received a lot of very precious, huge amount of teachings and debated with my classmates. We studied 4 years. So very fortunate to debate in the courtyard every evening. And sometimes sit down with your classmate and then just talk. Very inspiring. How does the object of reputation appear? Very inspiring. Yeah. So many teachers, they teach these subjects again and again, again and again. So yeah, that's for us, just today, only today actually. So it's not that much time. Yeah. But at least we put imprints in the mind, And those imprints are not lost. That's the advice we got always in the monastery. And we started with a difficult kind of subject, It's sometimes very difficult, especially in Tibetan, where certain text structure is quite tough, So then the teachers, they say, okay, don't worry, try to do your best, and then you understand a little bit, you put imprints in the mind, and a few years down the line, slowly it comes, So that's, for me, never came, but at least the seeds are there, So, yeah. So that's also when we were in Gyumetantra College, there's 1 year of Saraje, or generally speaking, the monasteries are quite intense, But compared to, I did university in Netherlands, hydrology is just an average study. So compared to the university in the Netherlands, it was quite a good university. Then what we do in the monastic universities, there's no comparison. It's like the university in the West, like holiday. So in a monastery in Serra, for example, 6 times a week, And then it's from morning till late midnight. It's kind of, the day is full. So that's why I'm here in Jamyang. When Yangtze Rinpoche came here, I went with Yangtze Rinpoche for a walk one evening. He said, it's true, isn't it? After becoming Geshe, there's so much free time. It's true, because it's so intense. And then Gyumi was even more intense, So, but in Gyumi we received so many very rare transmissions and teachings. And so then the teacher also said, you put imprints in your mind and they will ripen one day. It's very moving. So that's the more we study and more we listen to teachings, that's why there's a lot of emphasis on listening, right? Or listening to the scriptures or transmissions. Those things are bring great benefits, Yeah. Yeah, I think that's enough sales talk for yesterday and today. So we go now into emptiness. So yesterday we touched it a little bit already, that the law of dependent origination, remember? So the law of dependent origination prevents oneself from falling into two extremes, eternalism and nihilism, right? Eternalism we described yesterday as a mind that thinks everything exists from its own sight without dependence, right? So we straight away see that's not possible because everything is interdependent, so we don't fall into that extreme. Then the other syllable, origination, we saw that things conventionally exist, right? If you put your head against a wall or a pillar, then you see conventionally, we're listening, we're writing things down, we're thinking. So that means nihilism can be, it's been taken away because we understand conventionally there is something, right? So that's origination, dependent origination, right? Those two terms. Then there's different levels of interdependence or dependent origination. Yeah. So it's good to know those different levels. I put them also in a little write-up. You can read for yourself. I just summarize it. Because if I just read and explain, then people might find it quite boring. In the monastery, it's like that. It's only certain teachers, like Khenpo Rinpoche Lobsang Tsering, he gave the essence, because he was already in his mid-80s and he couldn't teach that much anymore. So he just never had a book on the table. And he had everything in the mind, right? So then it's like, okay, where are you in the debate? And you can imagine there's like 20 classes, 20 different subjects who come for teachings, right? So you just ask, and in the 20 classes, there's a lot of subjects throughout the year, right? So there's a very complex system. So you just ask classmates, okay, which class are you? Where are you in the debate? Okay, that subject, okay. And then just from memory it comes, like that. It's very moving, very interesting. I'm also not reading from the text. I don't have that mind, of course, but then it's easier to just summarize it for you. So, 3 levels of dependent origination, right? Yeah. So the first level, we already talked about a few times, is the level of interdependence, through the power of cause and effect relationships. Because our body and mind is in cause and effect relationships, right? We put food in, drink in, something comes out, but in the meantime, it helps to sustain the body, right? So it is a whole complex system of cause and effect relationships, right? Isn't it? So within this complex system of the organs, the bones, the muscles, the vessels, you know, there is nothing that can be found that exists from its own side, right? Sometimes it's very powerful meditation. If you just from the tip of your toe to the crown of your head, just check, scan your body, like it's done often in the Theravada tradition, for example. Practice mindfulness of the body, right? Close placement of mindfulness of the body, one of the four. Close placement. Anyway, so I can't hear people, so they can't correct me. So, close placement of mindfulness. So there's one of the body, right? So it's like that. You scan, you know? And then actually you see that within that complex cause and effect relationship of the body, there's nothing that can exist from its own side, right? Though it appears to exist, sometimes mixed with the body, you know? Going to prasangika. But actually if you look, there's nothing to be found like that, right? And there's nothing to be found separate from the body, right? Because if you contemplate it well, and then first see how the eye appears, you know? So when somebody criticizes you, just be aware, you know? How does the eye appear, you know? So that's very important, you know? Or when affliction comes up, anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, you know? Check. What is coming up in the mind, you know? Saying, oh, this person, how dare this person, this is to me. Me, I, you know? So how does that I and me appear? Very interesting. So that's why I said, this object of refutation, as we technically call it, it appears, but it doesn't exist the way it appears. But in order to know it doesn't exist the way it appears, we first have to know how it appears, right? So that's why it's very difficult to recognize. That's the most difficult point of emptiness. The reasoning and logic is not that difficult, you know, and to get concentration is also not that difficult, you know, just take a few months off and you get the right conditions and you can get it, you know, if you have the right conditions. But this object refutation, that needs a lot of accumulation of merit and purification, otherwise it's very difficult to recognize. So then when somebody criticizes you, it's very clear. Or you know, afflictions come up, anger, strong anger, strong attachment, craving or grasping for something, you know, very strong. Or close to death, you know, maybe on this edge of a mountain or a building. Yeah, so that's why Rinpoche told me to do a retreat in my Maratika. My mind is like a garbage, you know, can filled with all kind of stuff. So I can't really meditate. But then the trip up and down was very, 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 very good experience. Because I generate some fear of falling off the cliff. And that, oh, look how it appears. So very interesting. Yeah. And of course, being there with the caves is amazing. Yeah. Anyway. So to get this object of refutation clear is very important. How does the eye appear? Right. And then you do the scanning of the body within this, you know, all the, you know, the causality. All the cells, they change, right? They change every certain organs, they change after a few years, right? All the cells, they change. Yeah. So, very interesting to see that the whole body actually is momentarily changing, you know, you see? So, this momentary changing aspect of reality, of impermanent phenomena, also helps us to cut down concrete aspects of reality, right? Because according to these four schools of Buddhist philosophy, right, explaining the different how the self arises. So there's one school where it says permanent, unitary, and autonomous or empowered, right? There's a very coarse aspect of how the self appears, right? So if you have an understanding of impermanence, it's very easy to cut down the permanent aspect, right? So that's why impermanence already helps to understand a little bit, you know, especially this level of dependent origination. Right? So that means that our body, you know, it's just a process of cause and effect relationships, right? Yeah, you put in food, get digested, comes out again, and in the meantime, we sustain the body, right? Yeah, so very interesting process. So there's no place in that process of cause and effect relationships, you know, or a little baby and you grow up. Once I saw a picture, very good picture, of a little newborn, then a few months old, a few years old, then 20, 25, then in the midst of life, you know, like, whoa, I'm in the middle of my life, you know. And then going, you know, decrease, that means become older and older and older, and then die, and then you see the corpse, and then you see the bones left. So you see the whole cycle in one life, very moving. So if you see that process also, there's no eye to be seen in that whole process, coming out of the womb until you die, right? This whole process of cause and effect relationships, there's no concrete, inherent from its own existing eye that actually is there. It looks, it appears to be there, but actually it's not. If you use logic, right? Yeah, so that's the body, right? Impermanent nature of the body. Right? Or the level of dependence of impermanence and cause and effect relationships, right? So the same is true for our mind, right? So we look at the screen, we think in a particular way, you know, we have the sense perceptions, we have mental consciousness. There's a whole process of cause and effect relationships, as we also talked about in the 12 links. There's an object, there's a sense power, or a kind of, a physical aspect of the body that is needed to perceive, right? Like the optic nerve, for example, yeah? And there's consciousness, right? Also, that process is full of causality. Nothing exists from its own side. Even our thoughts, you know, from waking up, thinking about things, every moment of consciousness, it goes from moment to moment. There's no concrete from its own side existing self to be found in this continuity of cause and effect relationships of consciousness, right? Right? So that means, also in that sense, causality helps us to understand this first level of dependent origination, that things cannot exist from their own side. Yes, a bit people can relate to. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a very, if the more you, in our tradition, we basically start, technically speaking, with object of refutation, right? In the meditation, selflessness of a person. Yeah. Selflessness of phenomena sometimes goes in many sutras, and it talks also about the first, the levels of dependent origination. To habituate your mind, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, as we see in the Heart Sutra. Because the more you habituate your mind to no eye, or the eye is only exists by dependent cause and effect. There's no concrete from its own side existing eye. Ear, same thing. We have an ear sense power, you know, and we have the object, the sound, and we have the consciousness. Right? This is a very complex system of cause and effect relationships. Also, that doesn't exist from its own side. No eye, no ear, no nose, same thing. No tongue, no body, no mind. The nose. It's a good one for Westerners, because we Westerners, we have, generally speaking, big noses, you know. So when we met with this holiness once, I mentioned the other day, you know, the project, you know, we built this house for Western monks to make it easier for the monks to study the traditional way, have the conditions a bit better, because coming from the West, etc. Still is a huge dropout, but yeah, it's better than before. So that means that when we met with His Holiness, when His Holiness said the Nalanda scholars made it so complicated, remember? I told you the story. Yeah? That we met with His Holiness, and His Holiness said, oh, Buddhism was so easy in the beginning, or simple. And then Nalanda scholars made it so complicated, right? And I give. But then His Holiness said straight away, but isn't these degenerated times, we have to, you know, use logic to prove different things of reality. And there's more afflictions in degenerated times, you know? So that's why. So then, going back to the nose, so then His Holiness said, oh, very good project, they're pleased. He said, in the future, maybe it can become a Kamsa. Kamsa means a kind of official, recognized group within the university. Yeah? So then, and His Holiness was joking, he said, you see, His Holiness always jokes and tease around, there's no harmful intent, it's just to relax, you know? So then His Holiness says, oh, then maybe, the name for the Kamsa can be Nagu Chembu Kamsa. Nagu means nose, Chembu means great or big. So, big nose Kamsa. It's a joke, you know. So His Holiness also teases people, you see. So it's kind of relaxed, you know. It's like, that helps to break down the eye as well. Very good. Yeah. So then, come back to impermanence. So you can see that no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. That's in this Prajaparamita text that goes to all these aspects of selflessness of phenomena, right? Other than the person. Yeah. So you habituate yourself to this interdependence by seeing the reasons of that, and later on when you meditate on the selflessness of a person, you can relate to that and the reasoning becomes easier, you know? So that's why the system is there in our tradition. In the Theravada tradition, for example, I'm always very inspired by Mahasi Saida from the Burmese tradition. Very interesting, especially in one of his recent published books, I think 2 years ago, Manual Special Insight, I think it's called. So in that manual, he talks about same thing, selflessness, you know, over the different chapters. So I went to the book and make notes, and very interesting, because if you meditate a lot, according to that interpretation about, you know, the momentary changing nature of body and mind, the process of body and mind, then one time when the eye comes up, you straight away see it cannot exist the way it is. You see? And also he says in the books, at that time, the meditator generates some fear. You see? It's very, very similar as we have in our tradition, because there should be some fear, kind of, ooh, the concreteness is not there, you know? So if people meditate on emptiness, there's a little bit of fear, it's a good sign, you know? As long as you, when you come out of the session, and you don't have the view of nihilism, that nothing exists at all, because then you're wrong, then you're not on the right track. You know? But if you come out of the session and you think, oh, there's nothing else in cause and effect relationships, scary. That's a good experience, you know? So that means that, why can fear come? Because we habituated to this concrete eye for so many lifetimes. And now you see it doesn't exist the way it appears, right? So then it's like a shock to the system. His Holiness describes his first insight, of course, a very humble aspect. Well, you can read. If you read Lama Tsongkhapa's biography, the new book by Thubten Jinpa, you know, in the foreword, his Holiness actually mentioned same thing. Like lightning, he said. But it's still a coarse aspect, his Holiness referred to. Yeah, but yeah, it's also in that book, Art of Kaza. Art of Happiness, I think, right? His Holiness talks about, I see some people nodding yes. They know the book because I always quote it. So there also, there's one, a few pages that talks about the experience of emptiness. So that means, also at the time of Lama Tsongkhapa, when Lama Tsongkhapa was teaching these things, you know, Jason Serap Sangye, you know, one of the great, great masters, so accomplished, who was so kind. Thanks to him, we have Gyume down the college. So this master, Jason Serap Sangye, when he was in the teachings with His Holiness, or not with His Holiness, I mean, His Holiness more or less same as Lama Tsongkhapa. So he was with Lama Tsongkhapa's teachings, then Lama Tsongkhapa was teaching emptiness, right? And then Serap Sangye went like this, like that. Can you see? Taking this one. Yeah? So that means that he got a shock, that the concrete eye, he saw it doesn't exist the way it appears. But conventionally, there is a person. Right? So that's a sign of proving emptiness and dependent origination. Very interesting story. You know? So if you understand well this law of cause and effect relationship of body and mind, or this process, you know, this mindfulness of body and mind, then when the object of refutation arises, also that you have to get familiar to, it's very easy to see it cannot exist the way it appears. Yeah? So, when we meditate in that way, the clue is not to lose the object of refutation. Yeah? So how does the eye appear? In a particular way. Yeah? So it appears in a particular way, and then most of us, most people say, when you start analyzing it, it fades away. You know, it happens. Then the picture is not clear. So then Lama Tsongkhapa says, go back. Again, recognize how does it appear. Then analyze. If it fades away, again recognize. Because if that object refutation appears very clear, without losing it, you analyze it. So with the corner of the mind, you hold it, right? You see how it appears. With the other corner of the mind, you analyze. Yeah? Same as we do concentration meditation, when one aspect of mind we count, with the other aspect of mind, we check if we don't get distracted, right? So here's the same thing. And Pabongka Rinpoche, in the in the Namdo Lakcha, the debris in the palm of your hand, that is a very brief explanation of emptiness, but it's a very good one. Very good one. Very good brief explanation of what is emptiness of the self of a person. It's not many pages. Very brief. That's a good starting point. But then later on, to understand that object refutation, you have to study a bit more the tenets. How does it appear? So then also, he says, Papungar Misha says, it's like, you walk and you can do two things. He says, talking to a person and looking at the road. Right. So for us, same thing. You walk in the city, and you know where you have to go, you check your map, and you keep one eye on the pavement as well, otherwise there's a problem. So you can do that. So in a similar way, you hold object refutation for one corner of the mind, and with the other aspect of the mind you analyze. Where is it? Does it exist within these cause and effect relationships of body and mind? You analyze, you see? And then you check, and then if you have this clear, then you see, okay, it appears like this. Not cannot exist within the body because it's organs and bones and flesh and muscles and blood vessels. And it's nothing concrete within the body, right? So then you see, it cannot exist. It's not separate, because if you put your body away and then see if it still appears, it's not there like that, The same for the mind, you check. There's all kind of thoughts, all kind of perception, things appear, think about different things. Also in the whole process of our mind, first you see how it arises. Okay, it's not in the body, maybe it's in the mind, and check. In this process of continuity of thoughts and perception, there's nothing that is concrete all by itself within consciousness. It doesn't exist. So then also it's not separate. So that's a kind of introduction. Easily. So you can see already that you need a very clear picture of how the eye appears, right? When you get angry, or attachment, or jealousy, or pride, or when somebody criticizes you, points out your mistakes, or close to death. Just imagine you're on the top of this building or mountain, and almost falling off, or in a car, and the car just goes over the cliff. or a plane that just goes into turbulence and goes down, or a parachute that doesn't go open. You can imagine if you just, or people have this kind of, I saw last year when I was here, because I was on the BBC News, I think I saw that people have this new sport. They have kind of, they want to be a bird, They're human, but they want to be a bird, so they have this kind of wings. Between the arms and the body, and they just jump out of the plane and then they go like that. And then I saw one who didn't have a parachute. He was landing down in a pile of cardboard boxes, and he became so famous. Amazing, isn't it? So amazing. But anyway, so and most of them, they have the parachute, so that means they're just flying there. But you can imagine if you're flying there and you go over mountains like that, like a bird. So then you can imagine if the parachute doesn't go open when there's no boxes on the floor, then it's a different story, So you can imagine the feeling. Or, when you almost, I don't know if you have experience, almost dying. I don't know. Experience. I almost died in Nepal on the falling of the cliff, but luckily Rimshi's blessing kept us on the road. But yeah, also once in the sea in San Sebastian in Spain, I almost died. And with accident with my brother, almost died. So not almost that I got, hurt, but it could have been much worse. So at that time it's kind of fear, very strong. So that's can be very helpful. So we need different angles to see how does it arise. Then you hold it and then you analyze. And then as soon as it fades away, again you go back to the experience. How does it appear? You see? So then it can happen, and that's why you need certain kind of concentration, because if you have a mind like I have, then it's like, you never get to the actual aspect of understanding emptiness, because you have to have a very strong concentration. How does it appear? Then, without any distraction, analyze. Is it within the body? No. Is it within the mind? No. It can't exist. You see? So if there's distraction in that process, then you don't come to that point. You see? So that's why you need concentration. So that's why we do concentration meditation as well. So that's, yeah, that's the introduction of the first level. Dependent origination by the power of cause and effect, right? Yeah? First level. Then the second level, dependent origination. That's by the power of dependence, right? So you can, yeah, you can just interpret it like parts and a collection of parts, right? It's kind of our body, same thing. There's individual limbs, individual organs, you know, individual muscles, individual bones, you know? And there's a collection of it all, which we call our human body, right? So, in the same way, within the individual parts, and within the collection, and between the parts and the collection, we cannot actually see a concrete eye, or find a concrete eye, how it appears. We cannot find that, because it's so interdependent. The individual parts depend upon each other, right? And to make the collection depends on the individual parts. So the collection itself is made up of these parts, and these parts individually relate with each other. Right? So also in that collection of dependence, there's no place for a concrete eye that exists all by itself, because it's all interdependent, right? Yeah. So if you do a meditation like that, similar, then you take away a leg or arm or part of a leg or arm, not physically, but you imagine. You know, it's very moving. It's very powerful meditation. Look how the eye appears. Then see if it's the whole collection. Then you take out one hand, or then it's still the same collection. Not the same collection anymore, right? And how the eye appears. Very moving. You know, it can be very strong. And then cut down a little bit more, that you only have left a few things just to be alive. You know, but without pain. You know, otherwise the pain will distract. So you just imagine. You know, and then you see kind of, oh, you know. If the collection is not there anymore, but the eye still appears, so it's not really the collection, right? And if your individual parts you put aside already, then it's not the feeling of the eye doesn't come with those parts. So it's not the individual parts, neither the collection, right? So then you see that how the eye appears, and you check. Then also within that relationship between individual parts and the collection of it, also there's no place for an eye to be found. You see that? Yeah. So yeah, that needs time, you know, to check. Because our mind is mostly distracted to external objects and see everything as extremely concrete out there. You know? So now we have to look inwards and see, oh, how does it appear? You know, and then analyze. So yeah, it's the second level of interdependence of, yeah, we can say there's many interpretations to that, but this is, I find most helpful, you know, the parts and the collection of parts. So that's the body, same with consciousness, right? Yeah, we say body and mind, as we just discussed with the first level of law of cause and effect. Here, same thing. Consciousness, you know, we discussed already, yes, you know, five sense consciousness, right? One mental consciousness. You know? We have, you know, 51 mental factors, 73 or 100 and something, you know. So there's main minds, mental factors, you know. There's a very complex system of a collection of a consciousness with five omnipresent mental factors and a few object ascertaining mental factors whatsoever. There's also a collection of interdependence, because without the mental factors, consciousness cannot really function, right? Without wisdom, we cannot understand things. So the mental factor of wisdom is needed to analyze and come to a conclusion and realize things, right? And same with without the mental factor feeling, we cannot feel. Right? So contact, feeling, all those mental factors are needed to produce a form of consciousness, right? Yeah. So that means there's a whole collection of mental factors and consciousness by itself also. You can divide up in time, right? In the continuity of consciousness also there's different parts, right? So the collection of the consciousness, the mere collection of the stream of consciousness, so to say, right? In that stream of the individual parts of time, Also, we cannot find a self that exists from its own side. Neither among the different parts, nor in the collection. You see? So you can apply a similar logic as we just did with the body, you know, that actually the self cannot be found in consciousness like that. Yeah? Yeah, so you relate to that a little bit or not? Just getting some experience from study and then, you know, contemplate, study, contemplate, study, contemplate, and check. Ask somebody who knows a little bit more, and then slowly, slowly it comes, right? Like this meditator, Lobsang Tenzin, same thing. You know, initially he didn't have it, then someone said, oh, you study this, and went back and forth. And he also saw Dimaloja Rinpoche and a few other great masters to check. So that's a possibility, you know? Yeah. So there's the second level of interdependence, right? Number two. Then number three. Yeah, so now you need coffee. Or I just said water, but yeah, it's okay. Because number three is a little bit more kaza. Yeah, people say, yeah, cheers. Yeah, some people have coffee, I'm not sure. Just water. I had some coffee this morning. So, the third level of dependent origination is the most profound one, but the most difficult one to be understood. Yeah. So, to really understand, it's a tricky one. To really understand the third level, the most subtle level of conventional reality or conventional truth, actually you have to realize emptiness before that. Tricky, isn't it? But in order to realize emptiness, you can use the reasoning that is used in that method. You see? So you use the reason, and then you meditate, then you get emptiness, and then you actually really understand. Same with the strawberry jam made in a little village somewhere in the southern part of France or something. You know? When somebody describes it to you, you get an idea, but you don't have the taste. Right? You don't really, you know, it's very difficult. I explain to you how it tastes. Same when I came to the UK for the first time in the 80s, we hitchhiked from London to Scotland, to Edinburgh and back. And haggis, you know haggis? So we heard about haggis as a student, what is haggis? And people described it and thought, oh, that must be not very tasty. But still, we want to try it, you know? Then we tried and we took it once. Yeah. So that means that you can describe things, but you know, until you get a feeling, you don't really understand it, right? Yeah, so the same is true of this subtle, most subtle level of emptiness, which is called mere imputation, merely imputed by the mind. Yeah, according to Prasangika, a most subtle view of emptiness, or sorry, not the view of emptiness, most subtle view of conventional truth. Yeah, there's two truths, right? We have conventional truth and ultimate truth. So ultimate truth means emptiness, and conventional truth basically is everything else that exists than emptiness, right? The cup, the computer, the Zoom, it's all conventional truth. Yeah? Ultimate truth means empty of inherent existence, right? So this computer has one aspect, this conventional truth, right? The screen, you know, the things inside, the chips, everything, this is conventional truth. It also has subtle impermanence, aspect, because the computer is also momentary changing, right? They break down. You know? I could practice patience quite well with human beings until I got a little one to take care of, but I could practice patience quite well. But with computers, I had always a hard time. But yesterday with Zoom, or day before was it? Sunday, I think I did quite well, but normally I get quite annoyed with electric things when they don't work the way I wanted to work, you know? So, yeah. So then also this computer has an aspect of the screen and the chips, right? Conventional truth. It also has the aspect of subtle impermanence because it breaks down. Yeah, once I didn't save backup, I was working on a translation project and then the computer, you know, didn't work anymore. So I lost a lot of work. You know, so then you got a bit annoyed. You know? So, but also, let's see, the computer is also momentarily changing, right? So if you don't understand that, then it causes a problem. So this momentary changing nature of the computer is still a conventional truth, right? Yeah. The emptiness of the computer, meaning the computer is empty of inherent existence, that's what we call ultimate truth. So these two truths are very important to be understood. So when we study the 12 links over the last few days, that's all conventional truth. All the 12 links are all conventional truth. Right? To oppose ignorance, the first one, you have to realize emptiness. Right? So the mind that realizes emptiness is conventional truth, but the object emptiness is ultimate truth. Right? So ultimate truth means empty of inherent existence. Yeah? It's just for those who study a bit more. Then you know, because then you can relate also to this third level of dependent origination. Because dependent origination, all those three levels we describe, is all conventional truth, right? We use to understand ultimate truth. Yeah, so because we cannot see ultimate truth with our eyes, we cannot smell it, we cannot hear it, we cannot taste it, we cannot touch it. Yeah, so emptiness is being called a hidden phenomena that needs reasoning. Subtle impermanence, as we also described before, is also a hidden phenomena. We cannot see that the computer is momentarily changing. Of course, we can, you know, if I drop it, then Sylvia will not be very happy. But when I drop it, you know, the computer, it breaks, right? I mean, maybe not on the wooden floor, maybe I have to throw it up a bit, and then it drops and it breaks. That is coarse impermanence, right? It's not subtle. That we can all realize, it's not difficult. But that this computer is every split second is changing, that's a little bit more complicated, right? So that needs reasoning, you know? That's why we call it hidden phenomena, right? And well, a slightly hidden phenomena. Emptiness, same thing. Emptiness, we cannot directly see or hear or touch or feel or smell, you know? We have to use reasoning. So that's why there's a lot of emphasis on reasoning, otherwise you never understand emptiness, you know? So, because with our sense perceptions, we cannot perceive emptiness. We have to do it with mental consciousness. And as you know, mental consciousness has two aspects, conceptual and direct perception. Yeah, so then I go back to the beginning of the talk, yeah, direct perception of emptiness. So what's the difference? Yeah, conceptual consciousness is just like thinking. Close your eyes most of the time, not completely, but... And then you analyze. How does it appear? Can I find it in the body, in the mind? It doesn't exist the way it appears. There's all conceptuality, right? When I look at you at the screen and I see you, you know, with my eye consciousness, I see the color and the shape of people's faces and living rooms and, you know, people are drinking and doing what's going on behind their backs. Yeah, it's an interesting experience for me. Yeah. So that means that's direct perception. I don't have to reason that, you know, right? But that you all also momentarily changing, you know, if I know people over life, over many years, then maybe people see change, right? But it's still very coarse form of impermanence, you know? If you look in the mirror and you have more gray hairs coming through, you know, it's kind of quite coarse. You know? So if you understand the permanence, it's not a big deal. If you don't understand the permanence, then the first gray hair that comes out, you want to take out or color or, you know, pop a few pills or shampoo or whatsoever. So it doesn't really help because there's no stop to decay, right? You cannot stop. So if you understand if you understand the permanence, it's also easy to accept those things, you know, and take them to the part, right? So yeah, so that means those coarse aspects of people getting gray and wrinkles and, you know, those kind of things of life that happens to all of us at one point, if you make it that far, you know. So that's not that difficult to realize. We can see. Sometimes I see people every 5 years in the early days. When I came out of the monastery, came back to Europe, spent some time with family and friends, got a new visa back to India, you know. So you see people only once every 5 years, then you can see change. If you see people every day, then it doesn't really appear to you like that, you know? Yeah. So that means every day it doesn't appear to you like that because you don't understand this or see this subtle impermanence, right? You only see the big parts, like a few years, coarse forms of impermanence. So that means that the subtle forms of impermanence, we need reasoning to prove it. Yeah. So that's also with emptiness. We cannot see, we cannot touch it. So that's why we use reasoning. Yeah, so for that reasoning to happen, you need to study and you need to analyze. Otherwise, you know, it's not that easy. It doesn't come by a prayer and just, oh yeah, let me realize emptiness. This would be nice, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen. So we need some reasoning, you know. So that's why sometimes it looks a bit academic kind of approach, but it's not that difficult. In the beginning, it's, oh, it looks all difficult, you know, but after some time, you start to understand it. To realize is not a story, right? But to get a little bit of an idea what we're talking about, you know, that can be accomplished, right? Yeah. So, yeah. So then this third level of interdependence, yeah, the level of interdependence of kasa, mere imputed by the mind, merely labeled by the mind, right? So that means everything is just a mere imputation. Nothing exists from its own side. So if you look at a monocle, the different subatomic particles, then what we actually describe is a process upon which a mere process, not the process itself, but just a mere process upon which we label, oh, this is H2O, water, right? So same with our body, okay, there's legs, this, that. So that's a mere collection which is suitable to be called the human body, right? Yeah, but it is a label. So go back to one of the examples I gave. I find it very helpful. It's actually not my own example, Gisun Gelsen from Netherlands. He often used this example. If you have a showroom full of cars, you know, I mentioned the other day, and little boy throws stones on those cars, you think, oh, that's not nice of this boy, right? But then later on, you buy one of those cars, and you didn't, you know, the car is not moved whatsoever, you just signed a contract of the installments of the payments or something like that, you know? So it's just merely labeled, you see? Then the boy throws the stones, then you get so angry. But the car is still the same, exactly the same, showroom is the same, the boy is the same, but your relationship with that car is completely different. And it's just a signature on a piece of paper. It's just imputation, you see that? It's quite helpful, I find, yeah. So many things like that, you know. The president or the minister or this, that, it's kind of, it's just, they come into being a certain time and then you call them labels like that and we see them as so concrete, this and that. And, you know, so it's not like that, you see? So yeah, that's a little bit, this most difficult one to be understood, but at least you get a little bit of an idea. What is that merely labeled by the mind? In order to really understand it, you have to realize emptiness. You know, if you really have this, that's what it says in the scriptures, if you really have this insight, you know, there's no concrete I. And then you see it's just, like according to the first level, it's just a function and thing, of course, and effect relationships upon which we impute, you know, namdak, you know. Yeah, just, you cannot find it, but we say, oh, namdak. Why? It's not to be found, but we impute it on this mere collection. Who's sitting here with this cool kind of, you know, thing out coming out of my ear, talking to you. So it's kind of, yeah. But actually, where is he? You know? So if you do call your own name and say, where am I? Actually, you cannot find. Merely labeled, you see? So then the more you start to get a little bit idea of what emptiness is all about, then more you start to understand this merely imputed by the mind, you know? But it helps us to use that reasoning to come closer and closer to the understanding what emptiness actually means. You see? So that's why it's been used as a reasoning, but it's been realized after realizing emptiness. Yeah. So that's just a detail for those who study. Yeah. A little bit more. Yeah. So that's the three levels of interdependence. So yeah, perfect. Yeah, then in afternoon we do another reason, and that's one and different. Yeah? It's a very powerful one. Many meditators in the when they speak from experience, they say, of course, to start with dependent origination helps us. But then if you do meditation on one and different, you know, then the meditators say it's very powerful. Because then all of a sudden, you know, yeah, anyway, we talk about in the afternoon one and different. It's nice debate also, nice debates are. When we debate in the monastery, it's great fun sometimes. When you have certain, even in the first chapters of collective topics, there's called a subject called Zedok, substantial isolates, I think you can translate. I don't know. My terminology is not that good in English because I just hanging out in the monastery, everything in Tibet for all the time. You have to get used to the terminology. But yeah, so there's one debate. Whatever the opponent says, whatever he or she says, you can always put them in a loop that they're going to contradict themselves. So you win the debate, you see. Yeah, anyway, this is joking around, but it's very, yeah, very good way of using. If you train the mind in this debate, you know, you start to understand things. Lama Tsok Rinpoche, Rinpoche is giving these kind of YouTube kind of teachings, right, he says. So I only watched the first two. It was my first two teachings I received online in my entire life, so that you can know now why it's all new to me. So then I saw, because you get the emails and then it summarizes, so I read the summary. And then one day, it's like, Rinpoche said, oh, some people think Buddhism is all like quiet. You know, I don't know the video, but that's what Rinpoche expressed. But he said Buddhism can, practicing Buddhism can be very noisy. If you have 2,000 people clapping their hands at the same time, you can imagine. That's quite a, yeah. I told you the BBC, okay, said it's the noisiest place they've been to. Yeah, it's quite a, yeah, but yeah, it's quite amazing. It's very inspiring because everybody has fun and at the same time is analyzing these subtle points. It's very skillful. You know, when we receive teachings, again, Umla Juba, again, from Sandelek, who was the abbot of Gyume as well as Sergi. It's amazing. So he was like the father, you know, in the monastery. He had so many students. You know? And he, when we were just starting with the debates, he used to say, try to have fun and joke around. It's very nice. Because if you have fun and joke around, effort comes, things become easy, and irritation doesn't happen, you know. So very skillful. So that's why you can see in the debates, though it's all about your view, my view, you know. In the West, I've seen some discussions that people get quite a bit uptight sometimes. So if you have this advice, it's amazing, because then there's fun, effort comes, there's no hardships, and it's good to learn from each other. You know, in discussion groups, same thing. Nobody has the correct view. It can always be broken down. When we went to Ken Sitomichi Lobsang Tsering, we never had a book on the table, you know, I told you. So then he said, okay, you know, yeah, where are you? Okay, there, okay. So what is the meaning of this and this and this? He asked, one quotation. So we give an interpretation. Yeah, first the best of our class, they give the interpretation, right? And then he says, are you sure? Are you sure you're right? Yes, because here it says this and this, and the logic is like this, so it's all right. Are you really sure? He said, yes. And then he said, oh, you're gonna lose. And then he started debating us, you know? And that's so inspiring because we get other insights we didn't think about before. Other ways of logic. So that happens in discussion, right? Because we have just one mind who has one particular form of logic, while another person can think in a different way. So we can learn from each other, you know? So that's why discussion is very important. So in Nalanda, they asked me to give some talks about the 8 uncommon points of Prasangika next 2-3 weeks time. And I said, yeah, mainly just a little bit talking and then discussions, because they have already two fully qualified geshes there. So yeah, but anyway, they asked again and again. So then we do also discussion, but there's a bit more heavy stuff. It's called, anyway. So why I'm saying this? Yeah, just to relax people. Yeah. So, to debate. Yeah. Important to analyze, because it trains the mind to analytical meditation. You know, that's what we have to do. Yeah? Okay, everybody ready? We do a short meditation. Yeah. So, first we do the kasa, the counting of the breath, like yesterday. Yeah, and then, while doing the counting of the breath, also make sure you have those two mental factors. Extremely important, yeah? Alertness and mindfulness, because if you do analytical meditation, in the same way, you use these two mental factors, right, to not get distracted and keep your mind focused in the correct way of reasoning. You know, so if you're in this fire of debate, it's very interesting. Or you sit and you have to give an answer. You know, the mind gets really in a particular zone or a particular energy, you know, it trains into sharpness of thinking quick and clear. And if you do defend a particular statement for some time and not one or two or three or maybe your whole class is standing up and clapping their hands and firing questions, it's the mind gets quick. So then you can see, then the mind is analyzing, right? So then you go to the prayers. We always do prayers in between the two debate sessions. And then you can see your mind is still kind of going in this kind of way of thinking. So we need two aspects initially. We need concentration meditation and analytical meditation separately, right? And then later on, we can merge. And then it becomes a non-duality of the two. Yeah, so that's why we do separate. Yeah, because concentration harms analytical approach in the beginning. Analytical approach can harm the concentration. So later on, it becomes a union of the two. So that's why you have to use these two mental factors, because later on, analytical meditation you have to use, right? Yeah, too much talking, sorry. So, let's do the concentration of the breath. So the 9 rounds, you already know, right? So I don't have to explain. So we do the first 9 rounds, and then we do the kasa. Counting of the breath, yeah. So if people are done with the 9 rounds, then we do the concentration meditation of counting the breath, yeah, from 1 to 10, and then start over counting. And make sure you have those two mental factors present, so as soon as the mind gets distracted by you hear something outside or you think about past or future, don't pay attention to that, and let you, with mindfulness, you bring it back to the counting of the breath. Yeah, so let's do that for about a minute or two. So then when the mind is a little bit more subdued, has some concentration, then we imagine Sakyamuni Buddha in front, surrounding yourself with sentient beings on 6 rounds, in human form, undergoing individual suffering, and think, I have to realize emptiness. For that purpose, you know, I have to do the meditation, and for that purpose I have to request Buddha Sakyamuni to bestow blessings and inspiration. And then from the heart of Sakyamuni Buddha comes white nectar light, and you can reflect upon regrets, you know, and taking the motivation of bodhicitta. And then by receiving this white light, so you imagine all negative karma gets completely washed away, and all obstacles to meditation get specified, in particular, the obstacle that prevents you from understanding emptiness is being specified. Yeah? So we do this white light from the heart of Sakyamuni Buddha to the crown of your head for about visualization for about 2 minutes. and think that your whole body is filled with this white nectar light, and you're completely purified. Yeah? And all obstacles are being pacified. And have the power of resolve thinking. You don't engage in negative deeds anymore in the future, at least you try. Yeah? And then with the same motivation again, we request Sakyamuni Buddha in front, and this time yellow golden nectar light comes from his heart, crown of your head, fills your whole body. And by receiving this nectar light in the color of gold, yellowish, we think that we receive all the imprints for the potentials for the realizations to come about, and in particular, realization of emptiness. So we do this visualization of this yellow golden light also for about a minute or two. And then the body will be completely filled with this nectar light, completely suitable to meditate. And then try to recognize, remembering an event when somebody was criticizing you, or strong afflictions came up, like anger, or attachment, or jealousy, or pride, or fear, and see how the eye appeared. Mostly it seems to be appearing with it mixed with the aggregates, the level of your heart, or center of the body. So try to analyze how it appears. It's first step in this analytical meditation. Yeah? Calling an event and see how it appears. And then when there's clarity of the appearance, just hold it. You know, hold it for a minute or so. So that's the first step. And if you have a clear picture, then try to hold that without losing it, yeah, without let it fade away. And then at the same time, you try to see that the body, you know, it's just cause and effect relationships of the different things within the body, right? The skin and beyond the skin, the different aspects of the body, like the organs and the muscles, etc., bones. It's just a cause and effect relationship, right? So see and analyze that how the eye appears. That concrete existing from its own side, actually it cannot be found in this complexity, the process of body and mind, or body in this case first, of the process of cause and effect relationships. So try to analyze without losing it, and then towards the end you can see, oh, it doesn't exist within this complexity of cause and effects of the body, right? So try to analyze. And then try to see, oh, I cannot find it in the body. So then maybe the mind. So also the mind is made up of different moments and different types of consciousness, depending on objects, sense power, and consciousness itself. And that consciousness also depends on a previous moment. So within that complexity of the different types of consciousness being momentary changing, cause and effect relationships, also there is not really place for concrete eye, the way it appears. So analyze that also for about a minute or two. And also here, try to see, oh, can it be found the way it appears among that complexity process of cause and effect of the mind, right? Concentrate on that, can it be found? And then the overall conclusion, again, we try to recall how the eye appears. When it clearly appears, then we check again. Well, not in the body, not in the mind, because of the cause and effect relationship. It doesn't exist the way it appears. And so then we come to that conclusion, and then just think it doesn't exist. And then focus on that for about a minute. Right. So then, Sakyamuni Buddha, very pleased with your intention and comes to the crown of your head, becomes smaller and smaller, facing the same direction as you are, and then the size of your thumb, or even smaller than that, and then descends to the crown, and descends to the level of your heart, and you can think it becomes one with your own mind, level of your heart, and you can feel a little bit of bliss or happiness there. Right. So that's a little bit of meditation and emptiness. In order to get an object of refutation very clear, and knowing you have the right object of refutation, you're not throwing away the wrong one, then you have to study. Right? Yeah. As Sonya says, very humble in that introduction of Lama Tsongkhapa's biography of the Jinpa, that it was only the coarse one, Sonya said. So, but see, of course, it's a really nice prasanga view, but, you know, it's just give us a teaching, you know, that we have to see and check, see, check, see, check. Yeah, sounds like the getting rid of the coronavirus, what is it? Track, trace, and so there's some kind of sequence to that. Track, trace, something, yeah, anyway, yeah, what to do. So, Ale, test. Ale, sorry, yeah, thank you. Test, yeah, so same thing. Yeah, only a bit more profound, you know, takes more time probably. Yeah. It's not that easy, you know. With the testing is easy, you get if you get the right equipment, and you know, it's a matter of time. But the object of refutation, yeah, it's not, you cannot make it in a factory or something, or pay a few $1 billion and you know, you can make so many of them. So yeah, it takes a bit more. All right, so then the questions. Yeah.
First of all, thank you so much, Geshe-la, for the teachings. Thank you very, very much. And Geshe-la will read the questions, actually, because when I read them, it doesn't record. So, yes, I hope you can see them on the screen there. Thank you.
A bit of an echo.
Yes.
I put my cup.
Yes.
I put on the plate.
Big sound.
You can hear, yeah?
Yeah.
Distraction. Yeah, so okay, questions. We say that ignorance, the perception of an intrinsic self, is a poison affliction, afflicting our consciousness since beginningless lifetime. But where does this mistaken view
of reality come from? I think we did it yesterday. Could it be
okay.
the result of habituation?
Yes.
Yeah, sorry. It's a result of habituation since beginner's lifetime, right?
Yeah.
So there's no beginning of this apprehension of concrete self. Yeah, it's been present. You know? Like a baby, I said yesterday, knows how to drink the milk or knows how to breathe. You know, that's there. Since beginner's lifetime, they are born in human form as well, so they know, right? Yeah. Please, could you clarify? Alain, that's also afternoon, but yeah, I can try to clarify. What is the intended by self-sufficient in emptiness and out? Circulated. Yeah, so I just said two coarser forms of how the self appears. Yeah, one is you can find back in the, if you want to really know what I'm talking about and you're interested, there's a chart on that page number 4 of the text. I compiled a little bit together. You know? So on that page 4, it talks about coarse selflessness and subtle selflessness, right, of persons. So then certain Buddhist schools, they say the self, you know, or non-Buddhist schools, you know, they think the self is permanent, just keep the same translation, permanent, unitary, and independent. Yeah, sometimes translated as autonomous or empowered, the last term. So permanent means it looks like the self, sometimes it looks like to be existing without dependence on cause and conditions, right? So that's permanent, you know. Unitary means one. So in the afternoon, we're going to deal with that because it appears to be one, but there's many parts, right? So, but it appears to be one. So with understanding there's many parts, we refute the one aspect or the unitary aspect, you see? With cause and effect understanding, we refute the first point when it says permanent. You know? Okay. So permanent, unitary, independent or autonomous. So without dependence, right, on cause and conditions. So it depends on which school of Buddhist philosophy you give the interpretation of this particular term. So that's why we keep it simple today and tomorrow. So that's the first level. Then the second level in relation with this question, it talks a person, self-sufficient, substantial, existing self. Right? Rangya tuba zeyu in Tibetan. So rangya tuba zeyu. Actually, you can refer to as, you know, I always, for modern example, like a pilot in a plane. Right? The pilot is less depending upon the people in the plane than the people in the plane depending on the pilot. Right? In the flight, of course, if people don't fly, then the pilot doesn't have an income. But in the flight itself, it's a very modern example these days because unfortunately a lot of people lost their job who are in this, you know. Yeah, anyway. So, but the example is kind of the people, they depend more on the pilot than the pilot on the people, right? In the flying aspect. So sometimes it can appear that the self exists to be the controller, you know, be control over the aggregates. And some people say, oh, can I choose where I'd be born and, you know, be in control? But, you know, we cannot find the self like that. So how can you control? There's no control as such. You know? So that's the self-sufficient aspect. You know? Yeah? So that means that it's already a little bit more subtle. The previous one is like permanent, unitary, independent, like, you know, like a very solid aspect. Well, now there is already certain aspects of dependence because the people or the aggregates, they depend upon this self. But the self is lesser dependent on the aggregates. It's like in control, right? So already there's a likely appearance of dependence, but still self-sufficient in the sense the dependence is only from one side, right? Is that a bit clear or not? Yeah, so but that can be refuted because if there's dependence from one side, if the aggregates depend on the self, but how can the self not depend upon the aggregates? It cannot be possible. And also the self, if the self exists in that way, also should be, you know, it's within the law of cause and effect, right? So same with the pilot. You know, the pilot also depends on the people in the plane, right? There's a cause and effect relationship, you see? Yeah, so it appears sometimes that there is this controller, but is in control. The aggregates depend on itself, but But the self is not that much dependent on aggregate because he's in control of the whole thing. And also that cannot exist, right? So because in the Chandragriti sevenfold reasoning, for example, two of those reasons talks about inherent dependence, right, between the self and aggregates. So that means that if there's dependence from one side, then there should be dependence from the other side in the same way. Yeah. Nothing can have an inherent dependence. Inherent dependence doesn't exist, right? Yeah, you see that? I hope that's a little bit clear. Self-sufficient. Yeah. It's all terms, right? So some people find it difficult, the terms like self-sufficient, substantial. But yeah, it's good because if you see that, then you see, oh, there's a difference between the first one and the second. And then slowly you shape it, you know, you make it more and more subtle. And then things start to, because if you straight away dive into Prasangika view, it's not easy. I remember when I started with Buddhism in 93, the first book, I met Buddhism January 93. Then March was my birthday. And then my mother asked me, what do you want for your birthday? And I said, okay, liberation in the palm of your hand. So then she made a drawing. My mother is quite special, I think. She made a drawing. She didn't know I was a bit going spiritual direction, but that time she made a drawing. She is a bit of an artist, you know. So she had a book like that, you know, just like a sketch, kind of very nice. I have here in my room actually, and then behind the book, a monk arose. So she didn't know that I was becoming a monk, but yeah. Certainly in the mind, I thought, oh, maybe, yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, so I read that book, you know, and especially inside section, and you read like a novel, you know. Oh, yeah, Prasangika, interesting, easy to understand. You know, also in debate, it's very easy. Prasangika view to defend, because it's black and white, you know. You know, no inherent existence, everything merely imputed, thus, you know, easy. But to really understand, what does that mean, you know, merely imputed by the mind, or inherent existence? For that purpose, you have to study tenets. You have to see, you know, because later on, actually, I realized that my understanding of Prasangika was like nothing. It's just reading like a novel and think, oh yeah, interesting, looks like that. You know, but you have to study more and more because your understanding in the first reading, you don't get it. It looks interesting, but in order to really understand what it actually means, you have to study a bit more. So that's why you have to know those different levels, right? Yeah. So this thing I made for the course here in Jiangyang last year is just an extremely brief summary of tenets and a few other things. But yeah, so that by itself is not enough, of course. Yeah. So if you have time, then it's good to study tenets. You know, there's a few things in the basic program, for example, you can study. Yeah, or emptiness, by the way, reads His Holiness book, like see yourself as you really are, right? Yeah, that's one book by His Holiness. It's just a paperback, not that thick. Very good. Introduction-like. Yeah, so see yourself as you really are. Yeah, that's a good one. Then, if you want to do a little bit more, then yeah, you have to read tenets a little bit, right? Or this Pabongka Rinpoche's inside section, or the middle length Lamrim, or the great exposition of stages of part of Lai Middle Lama Tsongkhapa, or a books by His Holiness. I mentioned The Middle Way on the first day, remember? Because The Middle Way, actually, that book published by Wisdom Publications, I think Tupte Jinpa translated it. The Middle Way, that book is not that thick, but actually goes to the same chapters as we going through. Yeah, so it can also be helpful. Yeah. Yeah, but eventually, yeah, it's good to. That's why Lobsang Thenzin is holding his shoulder, you know, this meditator. Read the inside section of the Great Lam Rim by Lama Tsongkhapa. And that Great Lam Rim of Lama Tsongkhapa, that's His Holiness escaped from Tibet. That's the main, among some other possessions, but it's the main book he took with him, you know. So this is a kind of sign. It's all translated now, so you have three volumes. Yeah, it's a little bit, you know, especially the inside section, you have to, yeah, bite, not just swallow, but you know, you have to. So yeah, it takes time. Yeah, I'm not sure. I understand. Yeah, also I'm not sure the difference between coarse and subtle selfness of persons in Prasangika Madhyamika school. Same goes for the difference between coarse and subtle self and so phenomena. Yeah. I have the same feeling. Many lamas have the same feeling. You know, so that, because maybe in the afternoon there's more time, but prasangika, the difference is that Yogacarasvatantika, the one just before, Yogacarasvatantika says, okay, everything is imputed, or some texts even say merely imputed, right? But if everything is merely imputed, if you look for the meaning of imputation, there's something to be found. Meaning, you can find something upon which you impute a person. For example, they say the main consciousness that is the illustration of a person, right, is considered to be the person, the basis for imputation of the person, right? That can be found. They also have that view. But then Prasangika says, but even that basis of imputation, if you look, the mainstream of consciousness, so to say, right? We also say, oh, the mainstream of consciousness is the person. Certain views are like that. But even this mainstream of consciousness that goes from this life to the next life, even that, if you check, there's all these moments, right? It's like it's like a river. My first spiritual experience before becoming a Buddhist, I think I got in Austria. I had a week, free, and I was using Chinese medicine and everything, you know. And then I thought I hitchhike, because you don't spend that much money, to Austria. And this time I didn't have a record to go to Spain, but only spending 5 guildens. But time-wise, I had a record, because I was all by myself. And I took only the better cars on the Autobahn in Germany. So it was mainly BMW and Mercedes at that time. And they rode fast. So I from from the Netherlands to Salzburg, you know, Salzburg, a little out of Salzburg, I took a place on the camping. I did it in 10 hours. So it was pretty quick. So, but anyway, that's not the story. So then I went to this, you know, place near the mountains, a little camping place. And it was like a river. And so it was a very quiet. I didn't know how to meditate, but at least I thought, oh, it's nice. But anyway, so the river comes from the mountain, right? That's only these days I think about like that. So it comes from the snow and it melts, and then water molecules come by and then enters in this beautiful lake, you know? So the water molecules in the river is only from the melting of the snow until they reach the lake, right? Isn't it? So a lot of the molecules are already gone. So what actually, where is actually the river? Right? That's the question. So same here with consciousness. We have all these moments of consciousness, but actually, where is it? You see? This can be helpful. I find it helpful. So that's why Prasangika says, even if you look for consciousness, there's nothing to be found other than the mere collection of its moments, which we call consciousness. You see that? So that's a little bit of difference between Prasangika and Svatantika and Madhyamika. But to understand this well, you have to study a bit more. There's one of the scholars who became not only the founder, but also director of the School of Dialectics, Tsinilabda in Dharamsala, Genups Yatso. So actually, they say he had a view of mind only quite strong. Because it's very convincing sometimes. In a debate, you know, if you study one view, are you really into it? You can refute other views. And in debate, you hold that view, and somebody else debates you prasangika, but you hold it. Hmm? To understand that view more, sometimes very convincing. So then this great scholar, great practitioner, master, he had this view of mind only quite strong. And then he had debate with His Holiness. And he is quite an amazing scholar, you know. And then His Holiness debate with him, and then, yeah, he got prasangika. Anyway, I heard a story like that, yeah. So yeah, it takes time. So next question is the yogi.
Geshe-la, I just wondered if you wanted to save the rest of the questions till this afternoon. It's obviously up to you, but we're over time now.
Yeah, it's true.
But it, obviously, it's your choice. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe the last question I do the middle two. You know, okay. I do yeah. Afternoon. Last question. Because it depends what we talked about. First level dependent origination, the mind doesn't think nothing exists, but instead starts to feel nothing matters. You see, that's not correct. because things do matter. Because if you really understand interdependence, it's just a matter of cause and effect relationships. Mm-hmm. So you're part of that. So whatever you do has a result, right? Whatever you do in this process has an effect. Why does it matter to go to work? Exactly, because if you don't work, you don't have income. If you don't have income, life is difficult. So if you have work and income, you can reserve some time to study these things, and then slowly, slowly, you know, you go on the path to enlightenment. It's not that everybody has to find a cave somewhere and disappear, because not everybody can go and do that. If you'd like Milarepa, then of course, best. True, I cannot say that's not true, but you know, it's true, right? If you can, if you like Milarepa, then the best way to dedicate your life is to, you know, be somewhere in the mountains, right? Get the realizations. So for us, it's not that easy. You can do it in London. I had a very, I mean, my mind is like, I said, like garbage, but I thought about some benefit in doing meditations, you see? It's just in the city. One of the great masters who showed so many signs at the time of death, you know, Kensei Rinpoche Ugin Tseten, you know, he did a retreat in an apartment in Switzerland for 3-4 years. Yeah? So that means that if you have a job, same thing, you can divide your time. The main thing is the mind. If you're up in the mountains and think, oh, I'm a meditator, but you don't know really how to meditate and do it correctly, then there's no benefit or progress, right? If you, the things we're talking about in the morning, you do some little bit, recollect these things, and throughout the day you put into practice, practicing patience, understanding reality of emptiness, then you have so many opportunities at a work level, at everything. Same in the monastery. I mean, don't think that monks just only, you know, sit and study and clap their hands in debate. I've been involved in so many projects, you know, with the monastery, with some universities. It's like, same thing, sometimes difficult, it's very difficult. Sometimes you put a lot of time and effort into it and the benefit is not as expected, same thing. But it's a kind of part of the practice, you know? So that's the same thing, yeah. Why does it matter that I eat? Yeah, so if you don't eat, that's true, you know, you have to sustain the body, but when you eat, you think you do it for this purpose of sustaining the body. Why? In order to understand reality. Why? To eliminate suffering. You see? Yeah. Yeah. So that is kind of, yeah. If you really understand cause-effect relationship and you know how to put things into practice, then every moment in life can be a very fortunate situation. So that's, if you study, you know, the precious human rebirth, for example, it's very good to answer this question. Study precious human rebirth. Because there it says, of course, having these things incredibly difficult to find. We're very fortunate people on the other side, you know, we hear all on the other side of the screen. You don't realize. You don't really realize how fortunate you are, you see. Because if you study those 18 points, and you can add 19.19 in time, and I can see the numbers drop over time as well. So that means that they're so fortunate to be able to think about these things. There's not many, especially emptiness. You know? That's extremely fortunate, right? So that's something you should know, that you did something in the past. So optimistic attitude, right? So then, is actually, I mean, if you really study the 18 points or Prasian Rebirth, it's like the impossible became possible, kind of. Or actually what doesn't exist became possible. It's like that. So it's so difficult from number, from reason, you know, example. Then on top of that, create meaning, you know. Having this precious rebirth, there's a great meaning of getting a good rebirth again and liberation and enlightenment, right? But also it says create meaning on every moment. Every single moment we had this opportunity, we can put it into practice. We're in courses for enlightenment, you know? So that's amazing. Yeah, so, yeah. If you think it that way, I'm generally speaking quite an optimistic person by nature. So, but yeah, to think about these points is kind of, yeah, let's do it, you know? And then, yeah, that's the right spirit, you know? And then even if you have commitments or engagements, then of course, you take it, try to take it into practice the best way you can, you know? And then you move forward. That's the thing. The mental training is not the external conditions or wearing malas, or, you know, some people say, oh, I'm a Buddhist and they have the malas, and, you know, some people dress up in different ways. Of course, monks, they have the vows to do that, but the real Buddhism or mental training is inside, right? It's not outside. We say, in Tibetan we say, Nangpa, Buddhism, a Buddhist. You know, Buddhist means Nangpa. Nang means inside. Pa means it becomes a person, inside person. Meaning that we train the mind, that's what it is. You know? That's what actually is called a Buddhist. Nangpa. Not interested in, of course, we have to relate to the external world, but the main thing is our mental training. How do we relate to the external world? You know? So that's, yeah. Yeah, so then the other two questions, if you can keep them and delete the other ones, then
keep them
for the afternoon. All right.
Thank you.
Sorry, over time again.
Yeah. Geshe-la, thank you so very much. Yeah. You know, on behalf of everyone, thank you for this morning. I hope you have an enjoyable non-self-existent lunch.
Yeah. And with lunch here, actually.
And we resume at 3 o'clock again.
3 o'clock. Yeah.
Room.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. So, quick
dedication. Yeah.
Quick dedication. Better than no dedication. Yeah, same for the morning and evening. Even if you do practice, you know, better to do short, but do it every day than, you know, oh, expired, interesting, 1 hour. Then a few days later, you know, no interest. Every day, a little bit. Yeah. Okay, so dedicate for the long and healthy life of the precious gurus and the spreading of the Buddha Dharma in all directions and all the holy wishes of the gurus to may be fulfilled. Gare rave gorve singhaso pendan deva mande jongve chere zi guan ten singhaso yin shabe si ten pa tu ten kyu chi. And then for the three principal aspects of the path to be realized by all sentient beings without exception. Yeah, nejun, and you can show short. Nejun sampa jambu sen. Toni tava rinpo che magye pa nan gigyo chi yeba namba me ba yang konen gonde da ba shu. And then oneself making the prayer, and the prayer itself and the aim we pray to is in the nature of dependent origination and empty of inherent existence. So by the power of this, may it all come true. And may ourselves and all sentient beings could achieve enlightenment, the state of Vajradhara. Deva gunda yanda dhamma 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 dhamma. Okay, thank you very much. Sorry, the overtime. Yeah. See you soon.